So I'll start with a confession of bait and switch. The title that you saw is a title that actually describes what may be doable with this, but I'll end the squeeze states instead of having them be the main focus. So there's a few contradictory looking things in the title, and I hope that you, badger me about them as the talk goes on. Feel free to interrupt. So I'm going to consider an ensemble of independent harmonic oscillators that share a controlled frequency. The motivation... They all have one frequency, and I get to control it. Yeah. And the motivation, or at least one motivation, could be atoms in an optical lattice, where you control the frequency of the lattice by tuning external to lasers. I have to admit, by magic to me, but... But anyway, that's the control problem. The motivation, or at least one motivation, is a heat engine that tries to cool and maybe make fancier Bose-Einstein condensates, for example, or just try to cool for a system near zero, near temperature zero. So it's a heat engine with two thermal contacts. The TC is presumably the temperature of the substance you're trying to cool with this heat engine. And there are two adiabatic branches where the field or frequency is switched, and two thermal branches where you just sort of wait and let it exchange heat. So diagrammed out, the heat engine cycle looks like I just drew there. The controls are all in the timing. So you have how long you allow the thermal contacts and how you change the frequency on the adiabats. No questions so far. Remarkably silent audience. Okay. So the rate limiting step, at least when you're trying to get to really low temperatures, is the adiabatic that jumps to the low temperature. And that's actually the focus of my talk. The rest of this was more or less just for motivation. Okay.
So omega 2 is smaller than omega 1?
Omega 2 is smaller than omega 1. One additional motivation, or maybe motivation for the whole setting, is to look for a dynamic version of the third law, or a finite time version of the third law. So I think I put down for my research interests control of thermodynamic systems. I've been doing that forever. This is more or less the first quantum example I've actually touched. But there's a lot of people involved, or a fair number of people involved in that endeavor, doing finite time limits on whatever thermodynamic processes exist. And in this case, it aims at looking at finite time versions of the third law of thermodynamics, the inaccessibility of zero temperature. And it basically is based on the fact that as you try to cool lower and lower, you have to do it slower and slower. You can't. It slows down naturally, and here's the argument. So if I operate a cycle between those two temperatures, the entropy production rate is the heating rate or heat exchange happening, the rate of heat exchange happening at the cold reservoir divided by that temperature, heat exchange at the hot reservoir divided by that temperature. That must be greater than zero, or greater than or equal to zero, if you believe in the equal portion, by the second law. If you assume a bound on how fast I can dump heat, then it rearranges into the cooling rate being bounded by a constant times the temperature. So as the temperature goes to zero, so must the cooling rate. And in fact, this cooling rate should go to zero at zero temperature, and what this delta is one of the implications of the control problem that I'm about to show you. In this setting, what I'd like to introduce is something I call a prelude process. So I'm going to look at this.
Peter, can you just go back for 1 second?
Yeah.
I mean, it seems as if you start with the first equation, you can't really reach any conclusions until you put in this bound on QH dot.
Right.
We know that in practice, any physical system has some kind of bound on rate. So that certainly seems reasonable. But
So this is a result of Rodney Kozlov and Jeff Gordon from, I don't know, 5 years ago or something on that.
But it seems almost as if you're building in the answer by that assumption.
It does. I confess.
There's a finite rate at which you can get to absolute zero, and it, you know, or it's, you know, it's, it comes out from assuming that there's a finite rate. You can't go faster than a certain. I mean, it's a little bit more than that. But
it's a little bit more than that, but this assumption right there, which is the key assumption here, right? The fact that I have a bound on the rate at which I can get heat out of the working fluid. If I'm willing to heat it to very high temperatures and assume Newton's law of cooling holds, then of course you wouldn't get this. But Newton's law of cooling for large temperature differences is pretty silly. And, well, it's as good as it is. I mean, I'm not...
Okay.
I have to admit that's
it's reasonable slightly physically, but you get at what you're assuming in a certain sense. I know a little bit more, but...
Yeah.
Do you also need infinitely high walls of that harmonic oscillator, because as you squeeze the system into the hot state, it might start tunneling out.
That's a good question. Let's think about that in a little bit. Really, you're close to absolute zero, so there's no occupation
in
the high.
So you assume it's already
critical. Yeah. I mean, how hot it is at the hot temperature reservoir, the high temperature.
Because it places a bound on how hot you can get in the hot part of your system.
Yes, it does. So maybe that will justify, or that can justify this. I know that that the publication of this dynamic version of the third law by Gordon and Kozlov actually didn't have the argument in this much detail. And I and lots of people sort of said, what's going on? And one of the things I managed to do is actually get this explicit assumption out of Ronnie. But we can give him a hard time about that when he arrives next week.
Just if I understand the process, then the omega 1 and omega, or at least the lower one, should change as you cool the cold reservoir.
The omega of this, probably.
So
that's
if you
right.
go to zero, you probably need the omega to change.
Also approaches.
So
yes.
Do you know what the range of the omega that we currently have?
Well, if you reach omega zero, just turn off the field.
Yeah, but that would depend if you yeah.
I mean,
you can of course turn it off not something. It's not adiabatic turning off, but maybe if you do it slowly.
Well, so adiabatic is actually a pretty central character here. It means many things, or at least a few things. One of them in thermodynamics books, no heat exchanger. Another one in adiabatic switching kind of context, where it's got to be very slow. Right? And you stay in the eigenstate.
I would assume you just want the population of the levels to stay constant. Change omega?
Well, population, this is a full density matrix treatment, so population doesn't mean very much. Except as, well, it's an observable, but it's an oscillating observable and it's not, yeah.
But during
the
dynamic
density? I will not assume it, if that's what you're asking. Do I need it? I do, in fact, as we'll see in a little bit.
Peter, where does the last proportionality T to the power of delta? Where is that?
Oops. It's just that this must go to zero as TC goes to zero by this inequality, which is just a rearrangement of that. And if it's going to zero as T goes to zero and somehow is a function of T or TC, then I suppose I should have a subscript C on this guy too.
Okay, let's TC.
Yeah. Then the question is how does it approach zero? It's the asymptotic expression for, so maybe a wiggly equals, asymptotically equals, right? What's the first power of T that comes into an Orban expansion?
Okay, if it's polynomial
in T. It's not polynomial. We'll see delta is not an integer.
But it has to be, whatever it is, it has to be less than 1.
It has to be bigger than 1.
Bigger than 1.
Yeah, it has to approach 0 quicker than
T. Because as you get to small t.
That's right. So this part of the inequality forces it to go to 0 faster than T. Or at the same rate, but in fact, it goes faster. Well, not that much faster. All right, so it really sort of suggests this notion of a prelude process. So a mechanical, reversible, Hamiltonian, conservative, whatever you want to call it, all of those apply. Process that's going to be a prelude to a thermal process. So I'm getting ready to do heat exchange. And it turns out that I have to be rather clever about it. If I'm not, then I get all kinds of extra entropy production, which turns into extra heat to pump from the cold system. So let's see how that comes about. Now some real, only for a slide or two, some real quantum mechanics. So the whole calculation's in the Heisenberg representation along the adiabats, so with just the Hamiltonian dynamics. This should not look shocking. The density matrix is constant here.
Assuming you're in a prelude
state. Yes, but actually also on the thermal contacts theory. I mean, you can do the conservative and the Lindblad dynamics.
Density matrix not constant in the thermal contacts.
But the question is whether when you're in the Heisenberg representation.
Yeah.
So the density matrix is time independent, the operator
okay.
Yeah, the operators evolve according to these two equations and the density matrix sits still. It's not that big a deal except that I'm gonna go to expectation values very quickly. So it's these equations that describe also not just how the operators themselves evolve, but how their expectation values will evolve. Okay.
why what Heisenberg graph? Because surely your representation for this dimension is a bit more natural.
I think not here, but you can also do it in the Schrodinger representation, of course. I think this is simpler. But I have to admit, I haven't done it in the... So I stole this problem from, or... Well... Okay, I stole the problem from Ronnie Kozlov's group. I came and visited, and there were two different people, Yair Rezek and Tova Feldman, that were working on different heat engines, trying to get down to low temperature. One of them was a pair of coupled spins, that's Tova's work, and actually, not for any good reason, but I went with the other one, I think Ronnie pointed me that way, to look at the other one, used the harmonic oscillator as the working fluid. So Tova actually, I think, works with the Schrodinger representation, and Yair works with the Heisenberg one, and it was just fate or chance or flip of the coin. I think you could do it either way. Although I think it's much uglier in the, I mean, the matrices are lots to play with. Never mind. Okay. In any case, as I said, this will be our main focus because I'm interested in the adiabatic branch. We'll look at this briefly just to sort of give us some idea how the heat exchange happens. But. All right, so in order to describe the time evolution of the Hamiltonian here, the energy, I need enough other operators. It's quadratic, and so I need two other quadratic operators to get me a set of closed equations, time evolution equations, for their expectation values. So these are at the operator level. But if you look at their time evolution,
I think that's the reason why the Heisenberg representation may be simpler, because of the fact that you have a closed algebra with just a small subset of the operators.
Yeah.
So operator state space much smaller.
Yeah, but I mean, again, there must be a way to do that within Schrodinger, maybe not. It's certainly an easy way to do it, so. And one of the things I'm hoping to learn, and I don't remember the names, but to talk to several people 2 weeks ago when I was here before. So how do you really calculate this damn Lie algebra? So I'm expecting some help there. In any case, all right. I'm switching. So this looks good, and I'm now going to switch to expectation values and time evolution of the expectation values of these three operators. But instead of using H, because I want it for the Hamiltonian and the optimal control, I switch to E here. Forgive me, but that's what happens. Collision of notation and a choice. So this is just this calculated out for those three operators, and then multiply by the density matrix, take the trace, and you got the expectation values evolving as you see here. I'm assuming my omega is, I have a range of available control.
If you go back to the equations of motion of the operators, you have the term partial of A with respect to T.
Yes.
And that's what gives rise to the omega dot.
Yes. That's exactly what gives rise to the omega dot terms. The only explicit time dependence there is omega as a function of t. And I get to make it whatever I want. All right, but it's all right there. Well, and there.
In some treatments, by the way, I see they'll just use lowercase h for the penultimate you define in optimal control.
So for next time I'll take
the capital H. You still get to use for the quantum mechanics, and then little h you get to use for the quantum control.
Sounds good. I'll take that advice next time. At this point, I think you, well, I could, but you probably wouldn't want to wait for it. I guess I'm going to look at some special cases of these equations.
But did you say, I was confused, you said now all of a sudden these are expectation values?
Yes.
So
I get essentially the same equation with the operators in there, and now multiply both sides of all equations by the density matrix, take the trace, everything just falls through, and now it's expectation values.
Well, what if you just started in the Schrodinger picture with expectation values, psi, operator, psi, and took the time for it, you get the same equation?
Well, psi is a delicate issue here, but it's density matrices. It's not pure states. I think if you assume pure state, then you don't have any zero temperature to approach. You're there.
But I'm pretty sure if you start with Leibniz von Neumann separation, you have gotten the same.
Yeah. That you do get. Yeah. But not with not with pure states, but with density matrices. I need that. There's a temperature involved here. These are real ensembles.
Where did the
doesn't matter if it's a pure state or not.
So this L star, which is somehow the adjoint of the dissipative part.
Yeah,
so where did the Lindblad parameters come into these equations?
They don't. This is adiabats.
Oh, okay. So the heat bath is turned off.
The heat bath is disconnected. Turned off, if you like.
Is this the prelude?
This is the prelude, yes. It's a prelude process. That's what I'm going to talk about the optimal control of. Yeah.
So that means that for most of the talk, you're not going to have dissipation because you're...
Really, I'm not going to have for all of it.
So you have basically the whole cycle is the kind of the motivation, but we're looking at actually the Hamiltonian.
Exactly.
Okay.
How do you implement that experimentally?
You do it quickly. Right? Heat exchange takes time, so.
Ah, okay.
But you can change traps.
Or you change.
That's the kind of things people do by getting traps.
Say that again.
You can change trap frequencies as a function of time. People do that with magnetic traps.
Well, that's changing omega, but how do you connect or disconnect the heat bath is the question, as I understood it. And that, well, it's a large hand-waving approximation. I don't know. Yeah, the quickly enough is a little bit of a problem, because as I was explaining the motivation here, now let's go back to that. Oops. The part that I'm talking about, which is really this step, is the rate-limiting step. So they couldn't do it quickly. I actually managed to do it pretty quickly. But some heat is exchanged. The problem is, and I know that when I talked to David before about this, he seemed to express skepticism. Lindblad is... Well, one way to describe dissipative dynamics, but there are other ways, and it's not so perfectly clear what's right. And it's also not so doable to do the heat exchange and the field changing at the same time in less than a controversial way. So the engine is a compromise between what's doable and what's what may be reality. But fortunately, I'm a theorist.
But there may be maybe an idealization of something which is done.
Yeah.
you know, if you have a buffer gas, which is at a colder temperature or a hotter temperature, that you mix in, if you could separate it out afterwards, and so on.
Well, so Cheng Chin, who is an experimentalist at the University of Chicago, assures me that, yeah, he can change omega really fast, in the order of 3-4 orders of magnitude faster than the oscillation, so that he had no problem with. He works with two optical lattices, one cesium, one sodium, sort of, and he can control their... How he does it, I don't really know, but... You know, take this in the large hand-waving approximation.
But the frequency in an optical lattice is just the power of the laser, so that you can switch on and off with an electron. I mean, the time scale is determined by electrons.
Yeah. So that can be done quickly, but how you bring one lattice into contact with the other, and you control the spacing and then they come close or not, that's actually something like what he described, but I'm hand-waving here. Yeah?
You're controlling the phase of the interfering lasers. So it is a matter of the speed of your electron to the modulators. So this is, again, more or less electronic thing that you can do almost different.
The contact and no contact?
You can displace, if you're talking about displacing that.
Okay.
This is, you know, almost instantly.
Aren't there some experiments where they actually can turn on and turn off interactions by changing the, let's say, the magnetic state or something like that?
Yes.
You can turn on and turn off interactions. So you could imagine turning on interactions with something at a higher temperature and then with something at a lower temperature.
Or you can combine those states.
Yeah.
You can even bring atoms close, and then you switch on an interaction which, you know, makes them talk across a little distance, so they're different. But of course, controlling a magnetic field is much slower than just the optical control that you can carry.
Okay. Now, all right, so since I'm willing to, I'm going to look at a couple of special cases of this. One is if I'm changing omega infinitely quickly, then I get this kind of jump conditions, what ELC before and after the jump are. One of the things to pay attention to is that, suppose, actually I'm going to leave that. We'll talk about how this works in a minute. I sort of have it here. So if I do sudden adiabats, if I switch omega instantaneously, I get what Ronnie and Tova Feldman have called quantum friction, and that's actually a lot of what I'm about to try to explain. So here's a little prelude, but I actually lose some of the energy or end up with some extra energy and some oscillation in the LC mode. But let's wait for that. If I'm still on the adiabat, if I hold omega constant, I mean, then omega stays its initial value, the energy stays its initial value, and L and C oscillate around. I guess, whoops. Yeah, so you can see that from here. If I set omega dot to zero, this is gone, and I just have rotation in those two coordinates, or an oscillation in the LC coordinates. So here's my only slide on the thermal exchange branches. So this is Lindblad dynamics, but for this case it gives something really simple. So the energy relaxes just exponentially with this rate constant gamma up, down, rate constant differences to its equilibrium value at that temperature. And the LC oscillation just decays away. Okay.
Remind me of the definition of C again.
C was the correlation, so it's PQ plus QP, rescaled by omega over 2, if I remember right.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah. While we're here, though, let me pause and say, okay, so at thermal equilibrium, the Lagrangian is zero by equipartition, and the correlation is zero by hand waving.
Random phase assumption. It's an ensemble.
It's an ensemble, so you have a collection of phases. So as you can see here, this will decay L and C to zero, so that's thermal equilibrium, and it'll decay the energy to what it needs to be at the temperature of the bath that it's down to. All right? So the heat contact to the heat bath is coherence decay in a very concrete fashion. All right, so so Ronnie's group has been at this for a long time. So this intrinsic friction paper, I think that's the first one, although it might be the second one. They wrote lots of papers on this intrinsic friction. It happens in this adiabatic control with any system that has a Hamiltonian at one time that doesn't commute with the Hamiltonian at a different time. And the consequences of that is that it always excites some parasitic oscillations. Oscillations you don't really want. It's the LC oscillation in the example that we have here. And if you go very quickly, so let's go back to these dynamics. So suppose L is zero. In that case, it ceases. I mean, L and C are zero at equilibrium. So I start changing omega. So omega dot is non-zero. L starts becoming non-zero. And I build up this, as long as I go at a finite rate, omega dot, I build up this LC oscillation while I change omega. That's the intrinsic friction that... That is referred to here. As I said, so there were these two heat engine efforts. Tova was working with coupled spins. Yair was working with the harmonic oscillator. But trying to change omega at a constant rate or exponential rate or different specific functions of time, and no matter how, the faster you try to get that process, the more friction you build up, so more LC oscillation occurs. And since this is a prelude process, when I hook the system to the cold heat bath, that LC oscillation decays and actually gives you entropy production. Heat, which you're going to then have to pump along with whatever cooling you're actually managing to achieve. So it seemed like it was limited in lots of ways. So really the effort that I did was to come up with frictionless adiabats. So this is adiabats in the quantum sense or the classical mechanics sense, except that they're fast. Okay. So to that end, to explain this intrinsic friction a little more, let's look at entropy in a quantum setting. So the von Neumann entropy is the trace rho log rho. Rho is the density matrix. That's conserved along the adiabat, no matter what I do. Okay. On the other hand, if it's a prelude process, what really is the relevant quantity is what, as far as I know, only Ronnie's group calls it that, but the energy entropy. That is to say, if I take the density matrix and express it in an energy basis, then the off-diagonal elements decay, and what I really have is the diagonal elements playing this game. Now, you can do this with any operator. In fact, the entropy defined by that operator is always greater than or equal to the von Neumann entropy. But if I start some interaction where that operator is the controlling one, like K contact to a heat bath where it's the energy eigenstates that the system jumps into, then the difference between the energy entropy and the von Neumann entropy show up as heat, as entropy production. The system moves, but the von Neumann entropy becomes the energy entropy in that thermal process. So this is a lot to swallow. Some questions here might be useful. Otherwise, I'm going on. Trivial to everyone? Okay. So this quantum friction happens when...
Basically, the energy entropy says that the coherences that you have in the density matrix are going to get lost.
Yeah.
And
that's going to be producing entropy.
So it already essentially counts them as zero.
Yeah. I mean, the decay, of course, takes time, right? So this will not instantaneously set them to zero, but contact with the heat bath will produce entropy according as these decay and the corresponding energy turns into heat. So I guess this just says that again, during the heat exchange, the energy in the LC oscillation shows up as heat. That's what Feldman and Kozlov's quantum friction is. So the adiabatic branch by itself is reversible. I can go back from any step, but if it's a prelude process, that is, if my intent is next to do a heat exchange, then any energy stuck in the LC oscillation is going to be extra heat. So that's really what I want to avoid. And now for adiabatic switching in the good old Einstein-Sommerfeld-Ehrenfest sense. So this is something that I was really happy when Yair finally managed to calculate. That's an arc sine. And this quantity X is apparently something you can just get from the Lie algebra. I'm also hoping for some help there. But being able to express the von Neumann entropy in terms of ELC and omega, h-bar squared, actually, I'm not sure I was so consistent in setting those in there. Some places they're set to 1. But this is an invariant. And in fact, you can view it as sort of the surrogate entropy here. And it's going to be constant. And what that forces is that when I go to the final omega, if I don't end up with LNC equal to 0, which is thermal equilibrium, remember, then E has to be higher. So I can't reach quite as low an energy. That makes sense. So this sets an energy minimum. And that minimum is what I would get in an adiabatic process that is changing omega infinitely slowly. Then I don't excite any LC oscillation, so forth. But then I don't get to pump at a very interesting rate.
So in the language of Lie algebra, X is some kind of Casimir invariant.
Yes. Okay, so actually the first optimal control problem I tried was, what's the minimum energy I can reach? And this actually already explains that, well, it's the one that's actually going to keep E over omega constant, assuming I start from a thermal state. So L squared or LNC are 0, and then I change omega adiabatically, and that'll give me the well-known invariant for the oscillator being E over omega. So that does require infinitely slowly. It's adiabatic switching. It's a nice general theorem. You can go to action angle variables and probably, well, certainly do this, keeping the action constant for any pair like that, but still infinitely slowly. The surprise here is that you can do it incredibly quickly. So let's get to that. I'm going to get to optimal control here. I'm introducing it as a easier and more powerful calculus of variations. It actually, so calculus of variations along 1950s was bogged down in trying to put in complicated differential equation constraints. And Pontryagin and company made an end run around that by just saying, look, we don't need any differential equations. Those really complicate the hell out of things. Just look at differential equations of this form, where I have explicitly the derivative equals something with no derivatives in it. Okay, no squares, no, I mean, the complication really came from trying to deal with a much more general set of differential equations. And so you could do this in the Lagrangian formalism, but this actually lends itself nicely to a Hamiltonian formalism. And that's the tool here. So you introduce a Hamiltonian, some X's are the state variables, U, and in the original problem, usually U is defined by the set of variables that don't have a dynamical equation. And so you separate your variables into the ones that do have their time derivatives given and the ones that don't. The ones that don't are the control variables. Okay. Then you set up this Hamiltonian, which involves n adjoint variables to complement the n state variables and the controls. And looks like this, and the dynamics pretty easily fall out, well, basically Hamilton's equations of motion. The optimality conditions are that any time at that particular lambda of t and x of t, this function should be maximum in the control u. And that's Hamilton, that's optimal control theory in one slide. All right. So now the question remains how to choose omega of t. Well, I mean, since the equations here don't look like the ones I described for what's needed for optimal control, I need to have derivatives of variables in terms of functions of variables that don't have derivatives in them. Introduce this, and here at least for the moment I'm going to control, I guess, omega dot over omega. But it's just, I'm really controlling omega. It's just the parameterization. And then write down the optimal control Hamiltonian. So as advertised, I guess this is my first equation, lambda 1 times the right side of that, lambda 2 times the right side of that, with a u put in for omega dot over omega, so forth. Okay. The thing to notice is u comes in linearly everywhere. So let's rearrange this and actually collect all the terms in u. And then there's other terms, and it's of this form. It's a linear. The Hamiltonian, the optimal control Hamiltonian, is linear in the control.
Well, that's just because the choice you make down.
Yeah. So it was a convenient choice, wasn't it?
Well, it's also, if you look at the original equations, you have, it's a linear and omega dot, so that's already...
Yeah. I mean, the omega dot over omega was a convenience, but, I mean, if I just did it in omega dot, it would still be... If I just chose u to be omega dot without including that term there, then I'd still get just u to the first power. So almost any way you do it, it comes out linear. This is a nice choice because, I mean, you get rid of those ratios. But it's not the only choice. In fact, I think after I left you, Yair and Ronnie changed it to omega squared here, where you can still integrate and actually got a closed form integral that went at a finite rate. They were very excited. That went at a finite rate, And you could explicitly solve in closed form how to do the adiabatic switching in a finite time and end up with the same thing that an adiabatic switch would do in infinite time. It's not the optimal, so I can't say I'm excited about that solution. But in any case, the parameterization here is not the only one that gives you nice things, but it is a convenient choice. And it does give you a linear Hamiltonian. Okay.
I'm just trying to think, because we have a sort of a formulation that we try to do this geophysics problem and make it an optimal control problem. And we get the equations of motion depending on the controls and the time derivatives of the controls. One sense, that this is just maybe for later discussion, we'll have to dig into it back and see what I remember. But it didn't matter you only had one control ultimately. Was your control, and the fact that the time derivative was there didn't matter. We kind of played around with it and found, at least in our equations, that it didn't matter that the time derivative was there. Because we tried to make it like a different, which one should we choose as the control, the time derivative or the control?
So typically you get conservation of difficulty. By reparametrizing it, it's not going to be too different.
Were you assuming that you want to stay in the same state of the oscillator?
No.
I don't care what state the system is in.
Well, I'm looking for frictionless solutions. I'm trying to reach the lowest energy state. But more than that, which of course means that you sort of have to... You don't keep them in eigenstates. You jump out and back in. It's a bit of a... It's magic. It's a magic move I'm about to show you. That's the solution to the problem here.
I guess it's not clear to me why the physical solution should change by the way you write the augmenting equation.
It doesn't. It doesn't.
Because you said Ronnie chose omega dot equals u omega squared.
Because they wanted a set of an analytic solution to this equation. As I said, before I got there, what they were doing is omega dot constant, or omega dot over omega constant. But then they had to do everything numerically. If you choose omega dot equals constant times omega squared, then actually you get something you can integrate all the way through analytically.
Times omega squared, as opposed to... What you're doing here is u, which is not constant.
Which is not constant, and I don't have a square out of it.
They chose constant times omega squared. Okay. Yeah.
And then they can integrate it. So then if you view that as u times omega squared, that's a slightly different parameterization. And then they chose, which isn't the optimal control, but they chose the control, that constant equal to, that parameter equal to a constant, or that control equal to a constant. And then they got something that's analytically solvable. That's the big... achievement there. And actually, they believe, and I guess not knowing any better, I probably believe it too, that solution also has something intimately implied by the Lie algebra that's actually acting here. But, I mean, the fact that you can explicitly solve it is probably, probably of interest. Okay.
I think I was trying to agree with you, at least I can't guarantee that if the equations change, it's the same, but in our equations, the parameterization didn't matter.
The conservation of difficulty theorem usually holds. I mean, you can reparameterize, but it just shuffles. You know, the bubble goes down here, but it comes up over here. So this structure, I mean, this is the same Hamiltonian I just took. I mean, I put in the fact that sigma and alpha depend on the lambda and x. Right? But so this structure for a Hamiltonian, the coefficient of u is usually referred to as the switching function, because the optimality, the maximality of this is a function of u, implies that when that switching function is positive, I want to be at the maximum, U when it's negative, I want to make U as small as possible. Although there are typically branches along which that switching function vanishes identically. And that's what this structure in the Hamiltonian usually leads to. Those are called turnpike theorems. They're typically in economics, but I've certainly seen them in a lot of thermodynamics problems as well. The reason for the turnpike or tollway, right, is you get to the tollway as quickly as possible, then you move along it, then you get off at the last minute. And that's your quickest way to get there. Okay. The surprising thing, so I chased this turnpike for 6 months. I took that out of here. But so the way you find those is you look at this equation. Sigma identically zero. If it's identically zero, then so is its time derivative, then so is its second time derivative. And then with that, you can solve for U, usually. Here, you get a system, and it takes about 4 times differentiating ugly messes, but then it just chases its tail. You get nowhere. I've never seen that, and nor have I met anyone else that's seen that before. So if you know of other examples like that, I'd be interested. It certainly made me scratch my head. And as I say, I sort of chased my tail for 6 months on this. But
Can you tell us what alpha was? Was that already on the previous slide?
It is. It's this. It's the non-U dependent part. But, yeah. So the theorem I had to prove basically by going back to a trick of Weierstrass and just very direct is that you never want to use a U that's intermediate between zero and infinity. Which is another way to say that a frequency between the smallest and the largest. The optimal control for this is bang bang. And actually, that's a theorem that I wish I had a simpler proof for. It was not easy. I don't know. But I'm going to spare you the details, don't worry. So the conclusion is that these singular branches, the turnpikes, are never used. The whole thing is bang bang. And here's what it looks like. So I start at the higher frequency. I, at the very first instant, jump to the low frequency, let it evolve there a little bit, jump back to the initial frequency, let it evolve there a little bit, jump to the final frequency, and I get there. And the whole thing has the same effect, initial state to final state, as a real adiabatic process that would take infinite time. Except that the whole thing takes on the order of one oscillation. And that's the fastest you can do it. If you try to go any faster, you have to have some friction. So these arc cosine terms are on the order of one, and you see that the waiting time is about half a period on each of the, on each of these weights. And here's the sum of those two. I don't know why I separated those, but I did. Yeah.
So this method appears so surprising in a harmonic oscillator because we know there are recurrences in the harmonic oscillator. So
there are what?
Recurrences, so revivals or repeats, if you like, right? And we know that one can exploit the fact that the dynamics of the harmonic oscillator is exactly periodic in order to get some interesting control effects and speed up things. Now, maybe one question is what would happen if you have some small unharmonicity in your system?
I think if you go to action angle variables, the same thing goes through. You get invariance of the action. Like, I mean, it's still oscillating. I don't know that it should be any different.
It's oscillating, but it is not you know, exactly periodically uniforming every period, which instinctively, maybe I'm not following exactly the dynamics that you're getting here.
I think you're following exactly the dynamics. The question is, will that translate to general action angle variables as the adiabatic theorem, the classical adiabatic theorem, does? And I have to admit that's a conjecture at this point, but I'll bet a fair amount of money.
Let's do that. How much? You can bet a dinner.
A nice dinner.
Nice dinner.
Okay, you're right. So just to sort of set this straight.
We're going
to
put this on the wiki. We need somebody to keep track of all of that.
Yes.
And then anyone want to place a
so you claim that if I make it enharmonic, I won't be able to find this fast switch?
This is my
your conjecture.
My conjecture. This is my conjecture. Of course, here are some of the biggest experts in the world on these things.
Let me make one comment, which is that when I first heard about this model, I found it very surprising. I mean, you're right that the harmonic oscillator is analytic, but I was we had some conversations with Christiane about photo association, and the fact that we were at the meeting too, I didn't get it. I was thinking in terms of an idealization of photo association. We started a harmonic oscillator that has a very, very low frequency, three orders of magnitude lower than the final frequency. So you start at the ground state of this very flat oscillator, when you get to the ground state of this oscillator, and you ask what's the fastest that I can do that. And if I change the frequency of the oscillator to this final frequency instantaneously, I don't get into the ground state. I create something
which and moves with the, of course, with the frequency. So we get the period of the big one.
So I had a conjecture at that time that the fastest you could take this thing and make it like this was adiabatic.
It is adiabatic. It's just fast and adiabatic. I mean, it doesn't stay, right? It actually moves you out of the pure state, if that's how you wish to view it. I mean, it creates an LC oscillation that starts, and then it starts oscillating here, it reverses here, right, just enough so that when you do the last jump, it's gone.
Yeah,
so that's why I say it's magic.
Just to finish with, so that's why I found this surprising, because I thought that maybe there's some fundamental theorem on how fast you can do this, which there is, but I thought it was going to be something on the order of just an adiabatic switching time, conventional adiabatic switching time. And then Peter showed you can do it within the time scale of one period. It wasn't obvious to me at all that was possible.
Now, in fact, you quite clearly said at the time you didn't believe it. It's okay.
But at least I was smart enough not to bet. Anyway.
Peter, can you go back like one or two slides? What was not clear to me is where do you?
How far?
That's fine. Where do you hide there that you don't want friction? Is that part of your control problem, or?
That's part of wanting to get to the lowest energy, the target energy. You want it's in the final transversality conditions, except that you...
So it's in there, but just implicitly? That's
yeah.
So if you had, just by if you had friction, you wouldn't get to the lowest energy.
That's correct.
And the lowest energy defines your target state.
That's correct. So I try to go from E0, L equals 0, C equals 0, to E final, which is, actually, I think that's coming up here. What happened? Don't I have that? I don't have that. Oh, I do have it, right there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is that correct that
as it were, in the Mar language, you have refocused your populations out of the LC domain.
Perfectly said, yeah.
So
it's spinnacle-like in some ways,
yeah. These guys are thinking in terms of eigenstates, slow time regime, but you've actually just refocused with a second thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
This is why you expect that anharmonic tones will make this imperfect, because this refocusing is based on revival in the harmonic oscillator.
Well, based on the fact that the classical adiabatic theorem goes through for general action angle variables, I expect. But, I mean, that's why it's worth betting.
And I can give you an example from the NMR. We have some pretty highly nonlinear systems in the NMR, and those refocusing processes still work pretty damn well.
Yeah, but not such a simple
process as this one, no.
But I'm assuming that it is not possible to see this part, I don't expect it to work. So maybe one can find that on an NMR analogy, a smarter pulse that can correct for that, and this would be very interesting. But,
so wait, if it takes a smarter pulse,
yes,
then who won?
I won.
Wait. My claim was only that you could do a fast adiabat.
Oh, okay. No. Okay, sure.
Which presumably, I mean, didn't say anything about complexity of the pulse, but we can refine the bet. I'm okay either way. I just want it clear.
So, Peter, I don't know if you have this, you know, if you show us this, but I think it would be very interesting to see like some kind of phase-based diagram of your dynamical variables. What happens to them when you do this?
Well, I can't do that immediately, although I can do something similar, and this actually might not be a bad time to do it. Let me go over here. So this is classical mechanics. You've seen these movies. It was, in fact, prompted. And in a folder called Squeeze States. It has little to do with squeeze states, but nonetheless. Okay, so here I have an initial QP. That would have been nice to label. I didn't do it, sorry. I take a microcanonical ensemble. So these are constant energy surfaces for one oscillator, but I mean, think of it as spread out over those ellipses. Just to illustrate, I'm going to pick a couple of points here. These were random choices. I tried it with a few of them and decided this was about, if you put too many, you can't see what the hell's going on. If you put too few, it's also hard to. Anyway, there's some compromise here, but let's see how they move. So just as an illustration, let's propagate a little. So all the blue stars move to the red ones, right? No surprise there. Now I'm going to switch frequencies. So all those red states are now moving on the green circles, which are the final frequency, So now I propagate the right time. I mean, it's not an arbitrary time. It's the tau 1 in that formula. Okay. And they move. Right? No big surprise there either, so now I'm at the black points. Okay. Now I'm going to switch back to the initial frequency. And that puts them on ellipses similar to this one, right? And now I propagate tau 2. Now this, I do wish I had used another color. I don't know how well you can see the cyan ones. That's where those moved. And this moved. And that moved. And I'm on the final circle. So I'm done. Now all I have to do is now everybody's on the final trajectory. Propagate a little just to sort of, now you can see them a little better. But okay, did that help?
An off-ramp and an off-ramp with no turnpike.
Yeah. Yeah, you just sort of teleported between the on-ramp and the off-ramp. Hey, I think that's it. Okay. So they didn't quite do what you asked for, but it's a classical version. That does illustrate the move.
With the expectation that I was like, you could probably have a little phase portrait.
You could. The thing is, it would be 3D, right? ELC or HLC, if I go to little h for the Hamiltonian. Right. I mean, one of the Hamiltonians. Okay, so let's summarize what I'm calling the magic. I get fast adiabatic switching. I can only extract the full maximum work from the switch if I have a time bigger than the minimum time. Otherwise, I have to create some parasitic oscillations. And this actually implies, I mean, this is thermodynamics more than quantum mechanics, but availability, the available work in the change in some external parameter, is something that's actually sort of at the heart of thermodynamics. So one way to say the second law is availability can only decrease. Available work can only be. Yeah. Anyway.
Is it obvious that this is unique? This is a unique switch. In other words, I could imagine that there might, because of kind of the symmetry of the oscillator in particular, that there's some other combination of times that would get me to the same.
No, it's unique for, well, no, if I'm willing to, there are longer times I can, it's the shortest time. For this time, it's unique. There are certainly other ways of getting from initial state to final one, in particular, almost any infinitely slow parameterization. The analytic one that Yair found with omega dot equals constant times omega squared, and probably lots of others. I mean, there are many ones I'm willing to spend longer. At this time, it's unique. And any shorter time has to actually waste some work, produce some entropy. So not only is this a new type of availability, it's an explicitly finite time availability. So it really sort of shows what time has to cost. No way around it. Yeah?
So this lower bound on time is something that you found it in quantum scenario, you wouldn't find it in a
classical scenario. Well, I'm embarrassed to admit, but you do find it also for the classical version of the... See, that's actually sort of a surprise to me, and it's... Now, I thought it was mostly my inexperience with quantum, but once I go to the expectation values, this doesn't know whether it's classical or quantum. I mean, it's an ensemble. I mean, I one oscillator I can control and stop. Two oscillators already, I'm better off looking at ELC. I mean, I can't stop two oscillators. They have that entropy given by the Casimir operator, the X. That's also a surprise to me. So I don't think it's explicitly quantum. You get it classically, too. And let's get back to where I was. Okay. And so, I mean, I'm just summarizing what I got out of the solution here. The third thing is I get the fastest frictionless way to do that branch of that heat engine cycle that I motivated it all by. And it implies that delta is 3/2. Okay, I constrained, so what came before, I don't know, this is interesting just for something else. If the intermediate frequencies, omega 1 and omega 2, that I jump to and from, right, the initial and final are still given, but the inter...
I don't see how you get a power law, I don't see how you get the coefficient for T, because the part...
that you were dealing with doesn't kind of have anything.
No, no, you have to put this back in the full cycle solution and grand canon. That's why I'm sweeping those details.
So this is presumably.
Someone holds up the rug.
So this is presumably closer to linear T than anything that was obtained with other types of.
Yes. Things. So, well, my.
It's the lowest power of T that was obtained with any other.
That's correct.
Numerical.
And I have a. Actually, I could even go to that. Maybe not that easily, but give me a little bit of. Yeah. So this figure. So this is experimental numerical solutions and optimizations of those heat engines. And so without that magic move, the exponents you get are 1.99 or 2.09 or 2.80, or that's the various ways of changing omega that Ronnie's group had. That answered your question, right?
It was 1.49
instead of 1.5. Yeah, well, it's also not quite at zero, right?
No, I'm just saying 1.5 might have some kind of fundamental significance.
I'd like to believe so, yeah. That's certainly the. I'd like to think it's more than hope, but yeah. And so I was showing you, this is the surface of the minimum, the height here is the minimum total time. It's with specific numbers put in for the initial and final frequencies, 2 and 1, if you care. That's why I get a 1/2. But the limiting tau min, if I allow the intermediate frequencies to not be constrained to lie within the interval omega I to omega F, which is the previous formulas. And I mean, these formulas are obtained with the assumption that the intermediate frequencies that I jump to in the two jumps lie within the interval initial to final frequency. Then I get these expressions, and it still comes out on the order of one oscillation. But if I'm willing to drop that constraint, then I find that I should really jump to zero and infinity, and it goes even faster. But in that case, the minimum time is that nice expression, which I'm going to leave you with. And on that note, now I get to squeeze states. Yeah. Okay.
You have omega 1 and omega 2, and you have omega F and omega I.
Mm-hmm.
Are they the same thing?
No. Well, not here. Let's go back a little further. Here. So now I'm allowing, this is omega 1, which here is the same as omega F. And if I constrain omega 1 and omega 2 to lie within there, then that's the best I can do. But if I take this to zero and this to infinity, I do even better.
Yeah, so then you're in your final expression, you have zero times infinity in the denominator, don't you?
No, I mean, you get a completely, I mean, then this formula doesn't apply, right? This was for the specific calculation where I'm constrained.
Could you go to the last slide?
Yeah.
There. So what happens to that denominator when omega 1 goes to 0 and omega 2 goes to infinity?
This doesn't have omega 1 and omega 2 in it, right? The sequence of frequencies, I start at the initial frequency, I go to the first frequency, I jump to the second frequency, and then I jump to the final frequency.
So omega I and omega F are fixed?
Those are fixed. If these two are constrained to lie in the interval of those two, then the best I get is the previous formula. If I drop that constraint, so this becomes zero, this becomes infinity, and I get that expression for the minimum time. Clear? And on that note, I get to squeeze states. So when David first saw this talk, he said, oh, well, let's see what happens if I put in Wigner functions and look at what this move does to a squeezed state. And as far as I can understand from his book, I mean, it's just sort of looking at a nice Gaussian packet oscillating around these. And if I do it, I can do different Gaussians, and that's the squeezing. And I have to admit, I don't know what it does, although it was in sort of preparing this talk that I had to really look that stuff over again and try to figure out what are squeeze states anyway. What is it you expect out of it? Why were you trying to look at what this move does to squeezed states?
You didn't even realize that you were showing us.
No, I didn't even realize it, so explain it to me, please.
You showed us that with respect to a circle.
Yeah, but I mean, as far as I understand, what you're interested in for squeeze states is I have some set of initial states here. It's not the full ellipse or whatever, and then I'm going to do this move, right? I mean, you do a Gaussian packet.
For distribution, you have the first moments and the second moments. And the difference you're describing here is only a difference in the first moments. But that's really not too relevant. What's relevant here is the second moments. In squeezing, the second moments is relevant, and that's what you've shown us that you don't have in control.
All right, I think you have to talk to me about this.
But if you know how to turn an ellipse into a circle.
And I think it's a different kind of ellipse circle than the one from squeeze states.
Yeah.
Because this PQ diagram isn't really a PQ diagram, it's an omega P and Q diagram. So when you change omega, something that would look like a circle in one of them looks like an ellipse in the other, although it's actually the circle in both.
I think that when you showed us PQ, didn't you? You showed us
I showed you PQ.
PQ going to a circle in PQ.
Yes. But
the difference maybe that you're getting at is that when you showed us this microcanonical.
Yeah, but I mean, then it applies to canonical just as well, and it applies to...
So if it applies to canonical, then that's the same as this, except that here there's the first moments which are also coming into the control, but then the first moments aren't the...
No, it's a different ensemble. This is not a thermal ensemble, right? I have it localized in PQ.
No, but what you're saying is that this initial state is correlation. And the initial state you started from there had zero correlation.
Right. Those are equilibrium. That's not to say you can't use it. The control's a little different from different values of LC. But one of the things you can do is say, start with some initial state and go to... and just extract the... I mean, and actually you can use any other frequency and end up at the same frequency. So I guess end up at the same frequency and still extract work from that correlation. So I know how to make moves for that.
Let me ask you to conjecture on something.
Okay.
So you showed us for a particular set of initial conditions with a certain value of V and a certain value of L and C equals zero. Right? You showed us an example with C equals zero.
And L equals zero.
And L equals zero.
Yeah, equilibrium to equilibrium, yeah.
So what I want to ask you to conjecture on is whether you think that this, you basically have this, let's say two switch solution.
Uh-huh.
Would you guess that you'll also get a minimum time optimal solution with exactly two switches for non-zero initial L and C?
Yeah, no, I have those. I didn't show you those, but I do have those.
Okay. And it's two switches. So.
Yes. Which actually...
Then I don't want to bet.
I shouldn't have told you, huh? Damn it.
I would have guessed that.
You would have guessed that you couldn't?
I would have guessed that it was still the same structure solution.
So I have to confess
then it doesn't add anything new, I don't think. Well, I don't see why you're...
I don't know. I was just trying to understand what it is that you wanted out of the damn things. I mean, you, and actually, Ronnie at the time also tried to talk to me about squeeze states, which sort of started making sense to me last night, I have to admit, when looking at your book one more time.
If you turn an elliptical distribution into a circular distribution, you're taking a squeeze state and turning it into a...
Yeah, but there's the difference as to whether it's... states of the vacuum or whatever, so they're centered at the origin or they're centered at some...
Well, the center is the first moments.
Yeah.
And everything you've shown us is about the second moments. The first moments is...
Is it about the second moments? It's
second
about...
Is, no,
yeah, I understand.
You were showing us that you took a certain width in PQ and changed widths. Widths are second moments. Correlation. These are all second moments.
Yeah, but can I do it to a wave packet centered over here? That I don't know. And I'm not even sure what I'm looking for. I mean, I can see what the move does to it, and I will, now that I've...
These states has nothing to do with where the center is. It only has to do with the widths.
I see, okay. Well, in that case, I suppose... I've squeezed it, although I'll feel better after having done the calculation for that, just to see what...
But the equations are linear in PLC, so an initial condition or a distribution thereof should not make any difference in the final outcome. Because each individual point in the
they're linear in ELC. They're actually what's referred to in optimal control as bilinear, right? I mean, if you look only at ELC, there's the U that multiplies it. Sorry to put you through this, but I mean, this isn't, it's linear in E, in L, and in C, but if it's omega ELC, then it's not linear. I guess... So here's a UC term, right? Or it's, yeah, so it's bilinear. The
given a control U, it does become...
Given a control U, it becomes linear, yeah. In the state variables, it's linear. And on that note, no, well, I keep thinking that was the last one, but I added this as a way to sort of cure the bait and switch about squeeze states. And if I've answered it, great. I hope to understand how I've answered it someday.
If you choose this magic time,
yeah,
you have your magic. If you choose time less than magic time, is still optimal control gives you something?
It gives you something, but not something I've been able to do analytically. I can do it numerically, and it looks sort of interesting. in terms of, I've mostly looked at the work. Remember, I'm interested in thermodynamics. It does a switching. It's nice and symmetric. And I mean, if you look at as a function of, I guess.
But generally speaking, can you find the optimal solution in this case if that T less?
Yes, numerically. Maybe one can do it analytically, and I have just not succeeded yet, but so far, numerically, yeah, no problem.
How do you know that you will have always optimal solution?
Well, the bang-bang, that theorem that I referred to along the way here, okay, so the lights we don't want. This theorem, this still holds. See, when I said I had to go back to Weierstrass, what I actually did was prove that if I take a purported optimal control and use a U that's not zero or infinity, I can take a little piece of that and replace it by a faster one between the same endpoints. As long as U is not zero or infinity, this is the U is omega dot, basically. It's the rate at which I'm changing omega. If I change it at a finite rate that isn't zero or infinity, I can take a little piece of such a path and replace it by a faster one that jumps. So I never want to use any U other than zero and infinity. So then the bang-bang result holds, even for that case. And then it's just, what's the fastest you can get out of, you still don't need more bangs than, I mean, you called it two. It's two constant sitting at the largest and smallest, but it's three jumps to, it's still the same structure and I can calculate with it, but I can't get a numerical, an analytic expression for the wait times in terms of the total time. But actually, maybe with more effort one could. I haven't succeeded, but I haven't tried that hard in that direction. I've looked at it, so in terms of tau, this is work you can get out. So there's tau min. So there's a certain amount of work I can get. And below that, it actually, here's what happens if I do it instantaneously. And I get a nice symmetric curve that I can fit pretty nicely with hyperbolic tangent and all kinds of sort of fudges. But and it's right on the money in terms of, but it's not an analytic solution. And numerically, I can see it.
Okay, but this is related to your application. It doesn't mean, you know, you mentioned that optimal control lead us in many applications to that global maximum minimum. And after you left, we discussed all of this and we realized that there is no such thing. That,
I have to admit that was not true.
Okay.
I tried to find it so I could send you to it, and it just...
The
Krotov does not find the global optimum. That was a statement of, well, a false fact.
So, I
can... We should have bet.
That one you should have bet.
Well, actually, it's a good point, because would Krotov be able to find this bang-bang solution?
You know, I have something. I tried it first with Krotov, and in fact, this is the example I referred to that jumps all the heck over the place. Krotov is really unstable on this. It does find it, just numerically, it's pretty ugly. And I can dig those out, but I didn't actually put him in there, but so So I don't know what to say, but you caught me. So in fact, what I was thinking of, I was trying to figure out what it was that I was trying to remember that made me think it was global. It isn't. You get a sufficient condition. If you have a converged Krotov solution, it satisfies the sufficient condition for optimality. And I think somehow my mind played games with me and turned global into sufficient, and it's just wrong. I don't know what else to say other than should have bet.
So I have a general question, maybe the easy one. You pointed out that your system of equations, describes the dynamics of this quantum system, but it could definitely describe the dynamics of a classical system. So maybe a general question that comes to my mind is, what do we learn by doing quantum dynamics with this system that we wouldn't learn if we use a classical system? And this is maybe a relevant question if one wants to motivate, for instance, an experimentalist to do an experiment with optical lattices or any of the systems that you have mentioned.
Whoa, okay, that was quite a mouthful. So what do we learn? Let's hear the question part again.
What do you do with quantum if the classical is good enough?
Well, the whole motivation came from trying to cool to absolute zero, right? This whole prelude process idea is not... Well, it's interesting also for a classical system, but certainly I was led to it by a quantum system, and the idea that, so the desire to cool in a way where I don't really care how much work it's going to take, I'm not trying to optimize efficiency of that cooler or anything. What I want is to pump maximally at a maximum rate and at lower and lower temperatures. So that, I think, sort of forces the quantum issue. But, I mean, it certainly has nice implications for classical macroscopic stuff. It's a good question. I don't know how to answer it better than that. And I don't feel like I've really done it justice. But that's all I got, so that's all you're going to get. I mean, at least out of me. Maybe the rest of the audience can help.
Michael. Well, to come back to the question about nonlinearity, you answered that you can take care of nonlinearity by introducing new set of action at angle variables, right? Yes. On the level of this subatomic, right?
No, I mean that has to come at the mechanics Hamiltonian, right?
So it will.
It's not optimal control that's going to have to go to action angle variables. Wow, it's back here.
Yeah, but if you introduce nonlinearity in quantum Hamiltonian, then you will not have the closed algebra. You will have essentially what will happen. The pole will not become nonlinear in these variables, but the dimension of the
system
will go up. So I don't see a clear reason why the result will work in nonlinear case.
So he may win a dinner, you mean?
No. Yes.
Well, I can live with that.
And this is a likely situation in NMR where the mean field may work, and then essentially nonlinearity on the quantum level will be translated into nonlinearity of the control of the time. But here is no clear reason why mean field should work.
My reason is that I should be able to go to action angle variables, stay in the same dimension. I mean, that kind of perturbation can't change that. Or at least I find it hard to believe that it does. But of course it can. I know it can. Otherwise it wouldn't be an interesting thing.
So what's the timeline for the bet?
The timeline for the bet?
17th of July.
Well, at the latest. Are you here that long? Well, then it better be done by the 10th. Yeah, I have to admit that I made a bet with Itamar Prokocha in, I think, 1979, and he collected the case of wiring in 2003, I believe.
Importantly, who's got the burden of proof? Does Peter prove that he cannot do your rules and he cannot?
Well, what I would expect for verification of this would be just a, you know, simulation of the dynamics of unharmonic system of nonlinearity and seeing what whether you can reach the goal with the systems. So this is a constructive proof.
Yeah, but I mean, the question was, who has the burden of constructing it?
Oh, right, some student, I suppose.
Well, not if it's to be done on site here.
That is correct. Yeah.
But I guess one of the likely scenarios I can imagine with the nonlinear case is that, well, you know, if you have a finite n-level system, but it's n-harmonic, then there's a recurrence time, which is determined by the commensurability of all of those frequencies. And if you really want a complete recurrence, then and you define recurrence in the sense of a mathematician, of exactly, you know, one with an infinite number of zeros overlap with your initial state. But just for example.
Yeah.
Then you're going to have to wait until the recurrence of all of those frequencies that have an irrational.
That sounds long.
That sounds long. It may be longer than July 17th.
Well, that's why I brought up the precedent of the bet with Itamar. I mean, if we don't decide now, I mean, the future's there.
There's no statute of limitations on it, but...
No statute of limitations. Although, I think July 10th is a nice target to aim for.
All right, so let's thank Peter.